Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Well, the John Clapper. Now I'm conflating Jim Comey and John and Clapper. You can understand why, because
you married them.
They're both on, have done their insufferable book tours. Comey's is over. Clapper's still goes on. Clapper was on with Tapper.
Oh, Clapper and Tapper.
That could be like a buddy cop film.
It just sounds like it.
So Clapper and Tapper. And Jim Clapper, responding to what the president had to say about him, let's hear from President Trump before he jetted off to his MS-13 summit in New York yesterday.
Looks like a very serious event, but we'll find out. When they look at the documents, I think people are going to see a lot of bad things happen. I hope it's not so, because if it is, there's never been anything like it in the history of our country. I mean, if you look at Clapper, he sort of admitted that they had spies in the campaign yesterday, inadvertently. But I hope it's not true, but it looks like it is. I think James Comey's got a lot of problems. If you look at what he did, if you look at all of the lies, the tremendous lies, if you look at all that's going on, I think James Comey's got a lot of problems. Now, at some point, they have an IG report, and then let's see what James Comey has to say. But I assume he's covered in the IG report. But if you look at what he said, all of the lies, all of the fiction, I think he's got a lot of problems.
So Comey's got a lot of problems, and Clapper's got a lot of problems, and Comey's not talking right now. He's counting his royalties money. Clapper is on with Jake Tapper at CNN, asked to respond to what the president had to say about him. And Clapper said this.
Did the intelligence community spy on President Trump and his campaign?
No, we did not. And that is a distortion of what I said. In fact, I had an aversion to the use of the term, and I thought I made that clear. And the important thing is here, what was this all about? Well, what it was about was trying to determine what the Russians were doing. Were they trying to gain access, infiltrate a political campaign? It didn't matter which campaign. And it had nothing to do with spying on the campaign per se. It was about the Russians, which is what we should all be concerned about, to include President Trump.
James Clapper, James Comey.
Yeah, James, what's going on?
I don't know.
You okay?
My mind's not working. A little slow on the uptake this morning. Clapper saying again what he's been saying all week, that this was to protect Trump. He should be ecstatic about it. But he said something else in his book that's remarkable. That's sort of an underreported to this point, it seems to me. He said that there's no doubt that the Russians threw the election to Trump. That's what Clapper says in his book.
Really? Where did he get that information?
Well, it's a good question because...
is that fake news?
Because the Obama administration, starting with the president, said from the outset to the present that though there were attempts to disrupt, interfere with the election, that there was no evidence that Russia was able to manipulate the election results in any material way. There was no way. So they threw the election to President Trump. Why? With a few grand in Facebook ads?
Facebook ads. Who cares? That's nothing.
Against a combined $1.5 billion spent by the two presidential candidates? I mean, it's just a remarkable statement.
We might learn more. I don't know if we're going to learn anything, but this Gang of Eight, a bipartisan group now of House and Senate leaders, are going to today see that intelligence from the FBI and Department of Justice. So we'll know about more about maybe an alleged spy. The only one not going, Paul Ryan, because he has a prior engagement, but he's going to be briefed later.
Well, we're probably not going to learn more because they're looking at highly classified information that they're not going to be allowed to disclose to the public. So
you think Chuck Schumer is going to be able to keep his mouth shut? Nancy Pelosi?
Yeah, I think they will. Okay. In this case, because
Adam Schiff, Mr. Sunday morning talk show guy.
Well, it's one thing to leak classified information, try not to have your fingerprints on it. It's another thing to have a press conference about it. So I suspect that's not going to happen. But I mean, will provide potentially a roadmap, which is important too, to get to information they can discover and then can disclose. Something else Clapper said with Tapper. I'm not going to have fun.
Clapper, Tapper. We could say it all day.
Clapper and Tapper, Tango and Cash.
Cagney and Lacey.
Turner and Hooch.
Starsky and Hutch. Anybody else? Thelma and Louise.
That's not a buddy cop movie.
Well, it's a buddy movie.
It's a buddy movie.
I'm just doing buddies.
With a happy ending, too, I might
yes,
add.
We love happy endings.
Frank Drebin.
I'll
have to think about more
Clapper Tapper.
More genres.
Sundays on CNN.
So Clapper also said of the spy matter. That's not a spy. He hates using that word that he uses. It's completely benign.
This is a very benign thing that where he engaged directly with two or three people about, and again, trying to glean insight into what might the Russians be doing here to gain access to the campaign.
Nothing to see here. You believe Jim Tapper, 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. And by the way, this is now called Spygate because that's what President Trump has termed it.
I know.
Yeah, and Spygate.
But he said that too to the reporters. It's now it's Spygate. That's what you're calling it. And everyone's looking around like, I'm not calling it Spygate, but all right, that's what we're going to label it because he likes to label things and give nicknames to certain people. So.
The more remarkable Clapper statement, though, is it about how innocent Spygate was? Or I just go back again. No one has said this. I mean, no one who considers themselves a serious person that relies on evidence. Clapper saying that there's no doubt that Russia threw the election to President Trump. Tony on the South Side, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Dan, first of all, before I ask you a question, clap on, tap off, clap on, tap off, Clapper, Tapper. It's going to be my head off.
Oh, that's not bad.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, come on now.
Yeah.
I love it. Listen, so if in fact the Department of Justice had a mole or a informant, as they call it, inside of the Trump campaign to make sure that they weren't influencing the election or, it wasn't about Trump, wouldn't they have at least told the principal candidate that, yeah, we got an informant in your campaign to make sure the Russians ain't messing with you? Is that like a professional courtesy or how does that work?
Well, it's a professional protocol. It's funny. We put that same question to James Fitzgerald, the famed FBI criminal profiler, yesterday on the show, and he said exactly that you would tell. Now, Clapper also said in that Tapper interview, how's that going?
Go again, Clapper.
Clapper, Tapper, Tony.
Clap on, tap off, clap on, tap off.
Clapper, Tapper. Yeah, that's pretty good.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, Tony is the one who gave us Tangerine Jesus for
Tangerine
Trump.
Jesus.
So, interestingly, though, Clapper, he knows it was about Russia and trying to prevent a Russian incursion into our elections. He knows that. But he didn't know about the informant that was outed. He doesn't know if Michael Caputo is telling the truth, that there was somebody else from some other agency that made a run at him. It's possible. He doesn't know because he's not apprised of these things. He shouldn't be, and that's per protocol. So he's not apprised of the
malfeasance.
Yeah, I mean, malfeasance. Yeah, exactly. Thanks for the call today. But, I mean, he's not apprised of, I guess he would argue, I'm not apprised of the way they carry out the operation, but I understand what the ultimate goal of the operation is. I don't know. It's just everything that comes out of this guy's mouth. He sounds like another Jim Comey, where he's politicizing. He's sort of rewriting the history of his decision making. He's politicizing the whole matter for what purpose? I mean, he was essentially asked if he committed a crime. He said he didn't, and he took umbrage at even the suggestion that the Clapper had committed any crimes. But, man, these guys, I understand that he's got a storied history of service to this country, and he's a general, and you want to defer some respect to the position. But it's hard to defer any respect to the positions they're taking.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today.
Dan and Amy, this is
a theme song to Starsky and Hutch, right?
Yeah, remember the show? Did you watch it? I thought those guys were hot. Who was hotter, Starsky or Hutch? 312-642-5600.
I liked Huggy Chucky. Bear.
No, Sugar Bear. No, it's Sugar Bear.
Sugar Bear.
Sugar Bear was awesome. He had the fur coats, you know, and he was jiving. He was awesome.
Yeah.
Sugar Bear.
That's who I wanted to be when I grew up. And I've come close.
You know what? You're like a bee, Sugar Bear. What if I started calling you Sugar Bear? Would that be weird?
Yeah, it would. And it would make me uncomfortable, so don't.
Would that be your Me Too moment?
A influential multi-million dollar Republican donor in Illinois is threatened to shut off his wallet access to Republicans if they don't vote to discharge a petition to force a vote on legislation to provide a permanent resolution to the DACA designee issue.
Who is that?
John Rowe, who's a former Exelon chairman,
yeah,
and a Exelon grand recipient of corporate welfare, thanks to a super minority of Republicans, but the most important Republican, Bruce Rauner.
Are they in the same wine club, possibly?
I don't know about that, but I know Exelon got a $2.5 billion bailout last year, thanks to Governor Rauner. $2.5 billion bailout for a company that reported a $2 billion net profit the year before. So that's John Rowe. He's a corporatist. John Rowe is making this threat. I'm not going to cut checks to Republicans if they don't, surrender to Democrats and just do a deal on DACA with nothing on border security, despite the president's over-the-top offer, compromise offer. By the way, John Rowe, just to give you a little sense of this, of course, Politico sort of half reports the story. Rowe's contributed more than $500,000 to campaigns over the last 3 years.
Yeah.
His most recent contributions, $20,000 to Rahm, $25,000 to Jesse Ruiz when he was running for attorney general in Dem primary.
Yeah.
Last 15 months, he included donations to Andre Thapedi, Iris Martinez, Christian Mitchell, Dan Burke, Chris Welch, Heather Staines, the 24th Ward Democrat organization, which Staines runs. Those are all Democrats. So, saber-rattling from a bipartisan combine donor. Striking fear in my heart, but unfortunately, it will strike the fear in the heart of some Republicans, and this is why we have no Republican Party in this state, effectively. We have a junior partner to the Democrat Party, financed, at least at the institutional level, by the same people. Right? This is the Republican Party philosophy. If the way to beat them is to join them, how is that working out for us, Mr. Rowe?
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Let freedom ring this afternoon at 2 with Sean Hannity, right before Joe Walsh at 5 on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. And just to set the record straight, we've had a struggle out of the gate today. I refer to James Clapper as John Clapper.
And I referred
no
to
relation.
Huggy Bear as Shuggy Bear and Starsky
Sugar
and Hutch.
Bear.
It's
Sugar Bear.
Sugar Bear.
Yes, but you said it is Huggy Bear.
It's Huggy Bear. That
you
was
were, we were saying
name.
Who is the hottest dude in Starsky and Hutch, and you said, I think, Paul Michael Glazer.
Yeah.
And I said, Huggy Bear, and you
quickly
corrected me incorrectly. You. Incorrectly. And then don't forget, Antonio Vargas reprised his Huggy Bear role in one of the great parody movies of all time, I'm Gonna Get You Sucker.
Oh, that's right.
Where he was Pimp of the Year.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, good stuff.
Watch Starsky and Hutch now on Netflix.
You can watch it starting at 9 o'clock. You can watch all day. You can have a little.
I can?
Yeah. Catch
oh,
up
thanks,
with the.
Thanks, man. You're the best.
Was it David Soul? Was that was
David,
the other
yeah,
one?
He,
David Soul
he,
and Paul Michael Glazer, right? Oh, yeah, sure. And that car, too.
That car was awesome.
All right. The NFL has new policy as it pertains to protesting the national anthem after much haggling between these billionaire NFL owners. I mean, these guys are really something.
Well, they're losing money, so they had to come up with a plan.
Well, they're not really losing money, but they are losing audience, and that will translate ultimately to losing money, and that's a problem. There's no question about it. They're, the valuation of the franchise is sure. They are proof, though, this NFL owners group that, as Thomas Sowell said, the least intelligent form of life is a committee. The NFL's new policy: teams can be fined if their players on the field during the national anthem are on the field and do not stand and show respect for the flag. Players, however, can elect to remain in the locker room until after the national anthem. They had previously been required to be on the field. So if you're on the field, you got to respect the flag, but you don't have to be on the field.
Right. So if you really, if you know that you are not going to stand up forever, whatever reason, you have the choice to use the locker room. They were 2 days ago talking about a 15-yard penalty. That's been taken off the table.
Right.
And here's Roger Goodell making the announcement. It was a press conference with all the owners, and he got up there real quick and then got out.
We made modifications to our anthem policy. We did that this morning after a great deal of discussion yesterday, again this morning. It was unanimously adopted by the clubs. Several owners are here. They're going to give you their perspective. But from our standpoint, this is a great opportunity to continue that partnership with our players and keep the focus on the progress and the programs that we think are so important in the communities. We're proud of that support, and we think that that's how change is really going to be made.
You know what I like to do in my off time? I like to listen to effete billionaires talk about how they're going to pamper millionaires.
Oh,
isn't that fun? Isn't
this
so
fun.
Important? Can't you just listen to the stylings, the rhetorical stylings of a Roger Goodell, of a Christopher Johnson, the owner of the Jets, of a Bidwell Kidd, the owner of the Cardinals, all day long? I could.
Oh, yeah. Because that once Roger
treat.
Goodell was done, then, yeah, the owner of the Cardinals came up and everybody. But, I mean, is this rule simply about protecting the NFL brand? I mean, will you watch NFL games now? Do you think we've accomplished something, or did the NFL cave to the media pressure put on by the president?
Media pressure. It's the flight of fans. The percentage of white men who said they follow the NFL dropped from 69% in 2014 to 47% in 2018. That's a 22 percentage point drop. We know what the ratings have been. Right, we saw a double-digit drop in viewership, and it's a television sport, and that's where a lot of the money is generated. So that's a problem. So they're trying to address this. Obviously, if there were adults in charge of anything here, or if there were adults playing on the field, there are some, and others there are not. It'd be real simple. So get your ass on the field, and then respect the flag when we go through the anthem, and then we play football. Is it that complicated?
It's not complicated at all.
Yeah.
Honestly, I think that this is long overdue. I'm glad that they did something because it became such a show. I mean, they never showed, rarely would ever show the national anthem unless some superstar was singing it. And then it became part of the game every Sunday. Oh, who's there? Remember at the Bears-Steelers game? Everybody stayed inside except for that one
Alejandro Villarreal.
And I was watching. I'm like, you got to be kidding me. That is so disrespectful to our country and to the men and women who have fought for our freedom, for those cowards to hide in the locker room. And thank God he walked out there and he stood so proudly, and I was so happy for him. I mean, but it's just a crazy part in our society.
New York Jets chairman Christopher Johnson, I mentioned, he said that his players are free to take a knee or perform some other protest without fear of repercussion for the team, that if he's fined by the NFL or they are, that he will happily pay those fines.
Andy, so they weren't in complete agreement, as Roger Goodell said.
Well,
I mean, Roger Goodell said
they're in agreement on the policy, and Christopher Johnson's just saying, as a team owner, if you want to continue to make a spectacle of yourself on the sidelines, I'll pay the fine.
Ugh.
Andy on 88, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Grow up.
Hi, guys. How are you today?
Good.
My question is, it's not really a question, it's going to be an observation. It's not going to be long before the NFL realizes they are controlled by the left media. When they show a split screen of, or ABC, NBC, CBS, or whoever, ESPN, shows a split screen of inside the locker room and on the field during the national anthem.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like that.
You know that that's coming.
Thanks for the call, Andy. Well, they don't have to allow cameras in the locker room,
and
obviously.
And then some players were saying, you know, this is forced patriotism. No, you don't like it here? Get out. Go live. Move to another country. Play in the Canadian Football League. You kidding me?
Well,
it's 2 minutes of your life. You stand up and you respect those who have fought for your freedoms. I mean, it's real simple. I don't get it.
Well,
people taking a knee.
It is real simple, and you don't have to respect the flag everywhere. You can find a time to protest, say whatever you have to say, but this is a private enterprise. And so you also have to abide the rules of your employer in this situation, or face repercussions, or not face repercussions, I guess, if you remember the Jets. But that's essentially what the owners are suggesting. You know, it's funny. Adam Silver at the NBA got ahead of this when all this controversy was disrupting the NFL, and just said, reminded the players what the policy is. And have you had any problems at the NBA? Is this a racist policy? Nobody. I haven't seen much in the way of problems in the NBA, and that has a much higher percentage of black athletes than does the NFL.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting when you kind of just set the ground rules in a respectful manner, understanding that people disagree and people have gripes with this president or this policy or what's going on in the country, and that's fine. But there's a time and the place for it, and as a league or as a team, we're going to say you don't make a spectacle of yourself during this time, because it detracts from what we're trying to do as a team, what we're trying to do as a league, the value we're trying to add to fans. It seems real simple. And Adam Silver was able to handle it at the NBA. You haven't really had a problem in Major League Baseball, only the NFL. You know why? Because the adults aren't in charge of the NFL. Mike in Bolingbrook, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, what's the protest about? It started out with the police officers. They were protesting police brutality and all that crap. What is the protest about?
They don't really
give them the right to protest. What, the flag?
Yeah. Well, they don't.
It started out with Colin Kaepernick and Black Lives Matter.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. So it started out with Colin Kaepernick and extolling the virtues of Fidel Castro. I mean, you know, you ask a different player, you get a different answer. You know, what's going on in our country? What the president said? Laura Ingraham saying Kevin Durant should just shut up and dribble. Yeah. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. It's grievance for grievance sake.
And when the press conference was released yesterday, the first question I had was the Players Association wasn't mentioned, and they're going to have an issue with it. And the previous caller said exactly what I was thinking. They're going to give the right to protest, have split screen in the locker room, and then the regular national anthem, if they show it on TV. They didn't show it on every game last year.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Mike. Speaking of the NFLPA, since you brought it up, their response was that they're going to review the policy and, quote, challenge any aspect of it that is inconsistent with the collective bargaining agreement, saying that the new rules contradict statements made to player leadership about the principles, values, and patriotism of our league. So they didn't exactly embrace it.
No.
Marty in Naperville.
Hey, guys. Great show, as usual. Listen, this whole national anthem is a big mask. The reason the NFL ratings and such are down, and it's been going down, is that it's a garbage product anymore. It's all show. It's not, you know, if you're going to have a show, a wrestling show, which is what football is turning into, then call it that and do that. But, you know, this protesting, there's a caller before said, what are they protesting? Nobody ever says that. What are they protesting? The ratings are going down because the NFL itself is going down in talent, in plays, in this 3 hours for a replay, in Aaron Rodgers throwing a ball that's non-catchable, but somebody was in 30 feet of him, so it's a pass interference. But if you're not a good quarterback, your receiver can get assaulted. It's a joke.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks, Marty. I think Marty's got a lot of grievances about the actual game, the rules of
yes.
the game, you know, the game on the field, not the
it's
game
changing
on
too.
The field before the game.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what one of the other rules they said, you know, running start on kickoff.
No running start at all on kickoffs.
You have to start locked in because they're obviously trying to reduce collisions.
Yeah.
Man, you think how many touchdowns Devin Hester would have scored if you couldn't get a running start and a kickoff? Oof.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
And now, we have the one and only Verlon from the South Side. Verlon, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
How y'all doing this morning? Now, me and my brother, I mean yesterday, just fought about this like cats and dogs because he's a social justice warrior and you know I'm a Republican. So it started out, and he Googled it because he, in the middle of our conversation, he Googled it to see how it started and why it started. It started out as oppression. Oppression of black people, whether it's criminal justice reform, whether it's police abuse, whether it's the killing in the communities by police and things of that nature. So Colin Kaepernick started off as oppression of the black community, the unequal sentencing of whites against blacks, like they get lesser time than blacks. So it's a general statement that covers a whole wide range of things. So when the last three callers said, what are they protesting about? That's what they were protesting about. Now, what I argue against my brother, which he always says I'm spinning the subject, I said, well, the flag don't have a thing to do with the police. The police is just here to serve and protect the community, whether they're wrong or right. Why would you be kneeling in front of the flag, the greatest flag on earth that we fought for a revolution, for a civil war, and to free black people? That's just the wrong thing to be kneeling in front of, and the national anthem. And he always say that I've assimilated, and assimilation is the wrong thing to do. And we went back and forth about it, but yeah, that's a long drawn out argument. We always argue, we never agree. But you wanted to know how it started.
Yeah.
That's how it started.
Thanks for the cover. But your point is right. It's everybody's flag, and it's everybody's country. And it seems to me that those people that are kneeling, particularly the Colin Kaepernicks of the world, moron that he is, they remind me of the slogan suggestion for the Democrats of the midterms we got yesterday: "Make America Hate America." That seems to be what their effort is, and I don't think it's going to work out as well for them as they think it is.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So yesterday, Chicago police off-duty officers were out in the streets protesting Tiny Dancer.
Yeah, chanting, "Rom must go and we are CPD.
Rom must go! Rom must go! Rom must go!"
And I have to tell you, I mean, you normally see police officers at protests, guiding the protesters. So to see police officers, off-duty officers, marching was pretty cool. They had flags
and signs.
They
should have used Tiny Dancer.
Oh.
Rather than Rom, Tiny Dancer must go.
They were holding
my only quibble.
Signs that said, "Back the Blue" and "Blue Lives Matter." And they were protesting mostly the status of Officer Robert Realmo. He was the officer involved in the shooting of LeGreer and Betty Jones. Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
But the case is now before the police board, and they want to make sure that he's treated properly.
Is this the kangaroo court that decides police misconduct allegations? Sadly, it is. COPA is a political witch hunt on police officers. The investigations are unfair and politically motivated.
So they took their protest to City Hall. They circled around City Hall and then entered the chambers.
Yeah, it seems like this is bigger than one case. They're suggesting that Civilian Police Accountability Board is a kangaroo court, so police are not being treated fairly as a matter of course. Systemic, to borrow a term from the task force report on Chicago police from a couple of years ago that found systemic racism.
Yeah, and the police union also accuses Mayor Emanuel of not having their backs, and they criticize the mayor's Civilian Office of Police Accountability. And Mayor Emanuel, a soft-toned, a tranquil Mayor Emanuel, responded.
The issue of reform can be contentious. I get that. And can be loud. But it doesn't deter us from making the necessary changes, necessary investments, to achieve both the public safety and the reforms we need.
Was that Tiny Dancer or Roger Goodell? I mean, I can't distinguish the two. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Kevin Graham, who's the president of the Chicago Fraternal Order of Police. Kevin, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Dan.
So your guys and ladies were out there protesting Rahm yesterday, and as I suggested, it seems like it's more than about an individual case. It's about a general treatment. Am I right about that? And how are police being mistreated, if I am?
Well, thank you. First of all, let's tackle Robert Realmo. Someone came at him with a baseball bat. He was firing in self-defense. I don't think we have to wait until a police officer's head is opened up with a baseball bat in order to then make a response. Certainly, he was backing up and did what he could to protect himself. And I have said from the beginning, and I'll say it again, it is I'm very my heart goes out to the family that Betty
Jones.
She lost her life there. She was an innocent bystander, and that was unfortunate. But the reality was the officer was trying to protect himself from a man wielding a baseball bat trying to inflict serious harm on a police officer.
So what did they do to him? They put him on administrative leave, or what's happening to him?
Well, he's going to be in a no-pay status very soon, if not already. I don't have the exact date as to when he goes into the no-pay status, but it was 30 days from the time he was served, so probably I think he has another week or so to go. The reality is that there was a number of investigations that proved he did not use excessive force. Two of those investigations were hid from the police department and the superintendent. They did it through hiring an outside law firm.
Yeah.
They hired use of force experts, and then they refused to release those documents. That's not having a fair trial. That's not being open and transparent. That's saying, look, the public wants this officer to be treated harshly, and so I think that's what the message was. And so he certainly is at a disadvantage. And so we want to make sure that when people go in front of the police board or whether they're in front of COPA, that they are treated fairly. And that's all we're asking.
Well, what has changed in the culture and the way police officers that are involved in shootings and sometimes accused of misconduct, how they are being treated since the task force report in April of 2016, since the Department of Justice report where the Chicago Police Department was accused of being systemically racist? What's changed?
Well, first of all, I don't think that the task force was a report. I have been saying that's one person or a handful of people's manifesto.
I can see the point, but they're both political documents. The Department of Justice document was too. I mean, the things that were said in there are unbelievable. Essentially, they said, despite the fact that nearly half the police force is comprised of minorities, that there was essentially like a subtext where Chicago police officers were purposely trying to oppress minorities. I mean, those are some of the language used by Lori Lightfoot and others. So I can see the point that they're propaganda documents. My point is to say, how have those reports then influenced how police are being treated by these oversight bodies since those reports?
Well, I think they're using those as an excuse to treat police officers unfair. And I think one of the number one examples we can use is they keep talking about this code of silence. And, you know, I've been a police officer for more than 30 years. I started in 1983. I don't know of any code of silence. Okay. Neither does anybody else. Hmm. And I've said this before, if somebody's telling you there's a code of silence, here's the first question you need to ask: who and when, and what did you do about it when you found out? Because that seems to be, you know, one thing that has eluded everyone. Okay. What are they talking about? Who's covering up what? And so that was something that was named in this document that they call a report. And they can't prove it. So now what they're doing is trying to treat police officers unfairly by not giving them their just dues. They're already making them defend themselves instead of proving their guilt. So the officers have to prove that they're innocent rather than there's an assumption of.
What else has changed since those reports and the big hullabaloo surrounding them in terms of there was talk about more training?
They're opening a new police academy. Yeah, and that's supposed to make things all better.
Just generally speaking, the culture in the Chicago Police Department, how has it changed, requirements for officers, training that officers undergo, and the like?
Well, certainly they have already started with new training for use of force. And the problem is that now they're talking about changing the use of force policy again. Oh. And you have to have a consistent policy. You can't every 6 months decide we're going to have a change and expect officers to suddenly change what they've been doing for 30 years and then change 6 months later. But one of the main tools that has been changed in the police department is we have body cameras in all 22 police districts. We have body cameras. We have GPS in the cars. We have GPS in the portable data terminals that are in there. We have GPS in our radios. Where is an officer going to go where they're not located on GPS, where they're not on camera, and all of a sudden they think that something that we're somehow deceiving the public, that we're not transparent? I don't know how much more transparent you can get. And now they're talking about a civilian oversight board where you already have a district advisory board in all 22 districts. They're wasting taxpayers' dollars, and that shouldn't occur.
Right. Mayoral race is coming up. I mean, not too soon here, but in the near future.
Six months.
Yeah. So, right. Who is the FOP going to back, and is Gary McCarthy on the short list?
Gary, and I certainly don't want to. Gary McCarthy has asked for the endorsement of the Fraternal Order of Police. We have a meeting set up in June to bring in people who are asking for the endorsement, and we will make in the Political Action Committee will make a recommendation to the Board of Directors, and the Board of Directors at that time, the meeting following that, will make an endorsement or whatever the board decides. I mean, the board can decide that they aren't going to endorse anyone. They can wait until there are additional candidates. There's a number of options the board can do. So at this point, we haven't endorsed anyone.
Has Rahm got his slot secured on that endorsement meeting?
Mayor Emanuel has not asked for the endorsement.
Interesting. Oh, yeah, interesting. Lori Lightfoot, is she locked in for a time there?
Sure. Yeah.
No, she also has not asked for the endorsement.
All right, so. What about that like four-year-old rapper or that's running for mayor? What about him?
To the best of my knowledge, he has also not asked for the endorsement of FOP.
So it's going to be like Vallis and
a good thing.
It's going to be like Vallis and McCarthy. All right, so you guys are going to have a lot of quality time with those two.
Well, and we don't know who else is going to come up, but certainly we are willing to listen to legitimate candidates who want the endorsement and who see the problems in the city of Chicago. And, you know, I've said this before, I'll say it again. I think it's extremely important that the citizens of the city of Chicago know that we want to keep everyone safe. We don't want people robbed on Wells Street. We don't want people shot in Inglewood. And we want to make sure that people are safe everywhere. And we want to have a dialogue to make sure that that people are safe and crime doesn't get out of control.
Is crime out of control? And it's just sort of the new normal because of this, I would say largely the civilian political leadership you just mentioned. New use of force policy, now that's under review, maybe changes there. So you don't have any kind of stability and thus confidence in how police officers are going to be treated in the daily conduct of their jobs. I'm looking at the violent crime stats for this year as compared to last year. I mean, you know, 190 murders in May so far this year. There were 208 last year. But we're north of 200, 250 the last 3 years. And it just seems like even if there's some a little bit up 1 year and a little bit down the next year, that's significantly higher than the last decade leading up to the last 3 years. Has the civilian political leadership sort of lost control of this city?
Well, I'll answer that question in just one minute. I think one thing I want to make clear is that we do have a new head of COPA. We do have a new president of the police board, and I am hoping for some real change. I have a meeting scheduled to meet with the new president of the police board. I have met with the head of COPA, and the superintendent has been willing to talk to us all along. So, you know, I do hope that there is some change on the horizon. But in reference to your question is, they haven't consulted with the FOP, which is, you know, we speak for the membership of about 11,000 police officers that are active. Altogether, we have 17,000 members. And they have, in the past, they have not consulted with us, which has led to some of the problems that you have talked about and the rising crime. We have ideas, but, you know, they think if it only comes from the civilians and it only comes from them, that it's a good idea. And that's not true.
And what about, you just mentioned essentially staffing levels, the 11,000 active members. What about that? Do we need more cops on the streets in addition to more input from cops in terms of policing strategy?
Well, yeah. First of all, in the districts, we do need more officers. You have to remember, three districts were closed. Two detective areas were closed. The beats became larger. So, you know, what used to take four officers is now being handled by two. So you get into what are called RAPs, radio assignments pending. And we want to eliminate those RAPs. So we want to make sure that the staffing levels are up. And with all the new requirements that are placed upon us, when you have these long forms, when you stop someone to fill out, that takes people off the street. So now you're going to need, if you're going to increase the paperwork and take people off the street, you are going to need more police officers. So the number for the police department should be somewhere around 14,000, maybe 14,200. And that's the number at which we should probably be at. Now, we used to have what's called a 0.9 theory of manning, which accounted for many variables in how to put officers in those districts. We got away from that about 8-9 years ago, and we need to get back to a formula in which we can properly staff each of the 22 districts.
That would be a big jump in personnel, there's no question. Let me ask you another question. This forthcoming Laquan McDonald trial, obviously the officer involved in the Laquan McDonald shooting, how concerned are you about the repercussions for police and for, frankly, domestic tranquility in the city, depending on the outcome of that Van Dyke trial?
Well, you know, I don't want to make too many comments specifically on the trial because it's ongoing. I want them to have a fair trial. I do think that there is a lot that has not been said. I think that when people find out all of the facts and circumstances in the case, provided they listen, that they're going to be surprised at the outcome. I do think that if Officer Van Dyke has a fair trial, I think people will see a very different picture than what they saw for 5 seconds on the evening news. Having said that, I think that if the public is willing to listen to what occurred, I think they will understand, although many people in the city have already made up their minds because they've seen a video and to say, look, he's not guilty. I think people have a lot of questions, and certainly I am concerned that the city would be having problems. I think part of what my job is and part of what the police department's job is to make sure that people are prepared. If that is it, if he is found innocent, that the citizens of the city of Chicago need to remain calm and not be upset because they feel it should have gone the other way.
Well, so based on what you know, do you think that Officer Van Dyke will be acquitted or that he should be acquitted?
I believe that from what I have heard and what I know about cameras, that I think he will be acquitted.
So do I.
Really?
Yeah.
Really? Okay.
And what I know about the law. Mm-hmm. So having said those things, I can't predict how a trial is going to go or what a jury is going to do.
Sure.
Okay. I would imagine that that this is going to be a very focused case by people around the country. And if he has a fair trial, I do think he's going to be acquitted. And I think it is imperative that the people of the city of Chicago get a clear message as to why he was acquitted, so that people are not upset and thinking that there is something underhanded going on or that there isn't transparency.
He
so
is.
I think that's important.
He is Kevin Graham, president of the Chicago Fraternal Order of Police. Kevin, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is The Morning Show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
You want more than just the headlines? Find out what's going on and what it means with me, Dennis Prager, this morning at 11, right here on AM 560, The Answer.
Well, I've got some good news for you. The Great Rotundo took to the airwaves yesterday.
Oh, yes.
Forthcoming. I mean, this is good fodder for the forthcoming Obama Netflix show about Michael Rotundo, the Great Rotundo. Heroically fighting for the tenancy rights of other stay-at-home sons and adult children. And he did it yesterday with aplomb and savoir-faire.
So, yes, and he we're learning a lot about him, though. I've been reading up and studying about this guy because I want to know, because he said that he's in between jobs. Did he ever have a job? He had a job once at a Best Buy. Okay, so he moved out. He did live on his own for a year and a half. He got an apartment, and that's when he fathered this child with this woman that he's not in a relationship with. They were never married.
Mm-hmm.
He was enrolled in community college studying to be an engineer, but when the math got hard,
sure,
he switched to business and worked at Best Buy, and he filed a discrimination lawsuit against them because they fired him because he said he couldn't work on Saturdays because that is when he had visitation with his child. So he has a $340,000 lawsuit pending against the big box store for discrimination. So they kept saying, well,
that's the mother load, huh? That's his angle.
That's where he thinks he's going to get his bread and butter.
Never work again.
Now I won't have to do anything.
This, Office Space 2.
Yes.
The Best Buy.
He said he doesn't like living at home, but all right. But when they've asked you five times to leave, why aren't you getting the hint?
I would consider much of what they were doing to try to get me out as a tax, and what I was trying to—I was just, trying to preserve. Trying to do what's best for me, which is just, let's try to be a little more reasonable. I'll leave. I don't like living here, but I need, I need reasonable time. And as an example of this, the first notice that I received, the February 2nd notice, was basically, you have 14 days before you're outside in the winter weather. Winter weather. So the first thing I did when I got that was I made sure that wasn't going to happen. I contacted the police department. I said, is this something that's, this could happen? And they're like, no, you just call us. That they can't do that.
Then he barricaded himself in the basement. He sounds like a guy who's struggling for the words because he hasn't had human contact in about a decade. I think he's just learning to speak again.
So is he going to move out today?
Why don't you just move out of your parents' house, like, tomorrow?
I don't have the means to do that tomorrow.
Okay.
So,
do you have a job?
No.
Are you trying to get a job? Because I read that one of the things your parents asked of you, there are jobs available even for those with a poor work history like you. Get one.
Like at CNN.
You have to work. Are you working on that?
I have plans to be able to provide myself with the income I need to support myself, but it's not something that's going to come together tomorrow.
Uh-huh.
So,
yeah.
I'm
got a plan.
I'm trying to do what's best for me, and you know, I do want to leave, and I want to leave as soon as possible. But you know, it's not tomorrow. I don't think it should have to be tomorrow. And
you want it to be tomorrow. It just isn't tomorrow because you don't have the means
right
yet to make it tomorrow.
Yeah, don't you worry, Don Lemon. That was Don Lemon, right, interviewing him?
No,
sounded like
that was
him.
Brooke Baldwin.
Whatever. The lawsuit, huh?
Yeah, that's what, because he kept,
I got Best Buy right where I want him.
Kept creeping around. I said, "What is his backup plan? Is he writing a book? Is he some gamer?" Now I know exactly what that was. But he said this all
professional victim.
Well, it got bad when his parents stopped paying his cell phone bill.
Sure, sounds terrible.
And
horrific.
Then they told him to buy his own food, and you can't do your laundry here, so he'd have to actually leave and do his laundry somewhere else.
They're barbarians.
But they're real reason. Yes, and his 8-year-old son used to live with them, but the mother has gotten full custody now.
Shocking.
I'm going to send a letter that I've already prepared to my parents' attorney that says if you send an order to the court, it's a proposed order, that is for 3 months, there's a possibility the court won't accept that, although I don't think that makes any sense. I'm not a lawyer. I don't really know. But, you know, I guess the court can just can deny any proposed order that they like.
Yes.
Yeah.
But I would say that to the attorney. I'm saying to the attorney, if you put this proposed order for 3 months in, or a proposed order for 3 months in, I won't fight anymore for the case. And
okay,
the ironic thing is that if they had sent me the 6-month notice to quit in February, it would have cost them $0 in legal expenses.
Oh yeah. Okay. So the three don't talk to each other. They didn't in court, and they absolutely do not talk to each other in the house.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, he's best because he's busy playing Fortnite.
Well,
so he doesn't want it to be interrupted. But here's the other thing. I think that it would be easier to get Kim Jong-un to denuclearize North Korea than it would be to get this guy to understand how in the wrong he is, the rights he doesn't have, the privileges he shouldn't have, and how this is going to ultimately work out for him. And particularly, too, I mean, it's one thing to make fun of him if he's just, you know, this troglodyte living in his parents' basement playing video games. It's another thing when he's the father of an 8-year-old kid and you want to set an example for your son. That's the thing where it actually stops being funny and starts getting very sad.
Well, this is conjecture on my part after reading up on this. I think that he lost custody of his son because he doesn't have a job. He doesn't have health care. And that is a problem. So I think the parents, who, by the way, have been to court for visitation of their grandchild, because that was, you know, very hard on them when they, you know, the 8-year-old grandson's gone. They said he needs to get a job and have to have health care to provide for himself and the child if he ever wants to have custody of his son again.
Well,
see how that works out?
Well, yeah, this is not complicated. Why would he have custody in the first place?
I don't know.
Courts usually do not defer to the out of work 30-year-old gamer in the parents' basement with no income.
But the grandparents were providing food for the child and all that. But anyway, so how is the relationship with his parents?
You only have one mom and dad. And I understand that you are probably more
it's
upset
like talking
than
to an
even
11-year-old.
You're letting on. But don't you want to reconcile with them?
No.
Not until they give me my lunch
No,
meat.
I don't.
No.
Are you aware of the component regarding my son and about how I lost my visitation? Yeah. So right after that, they're like, well, we want you to start doing, don't worry about your case, which was, that's a full-time job doing and setting up an appeal for an order like that for custody and visitation. You know, what you need to do right now is get a full-time job and get health insurance, or we're going to throw you out. And it was devastating to lose my son. And I was just, it really,
okay.
I was done with them. I was done with them after that. I was done with them after that point.
Here's
they're trying to help you.
Here's something, Michael. So here's what people do who have jobs.
Yeah.
When there's a matter of a custodial dispute with a former spouse about visitation rights or whatever, they hire an attorney, and then the attorney represents their interests. I know that he's only 30, so he doesn't understand the ways of the world. And then the attorney represents your interests in court so that you can continue working your full-time job, providing food for yourself and other loved ones, providing shelter, and so forth. So the, I mean, it's the whole, you know, it's a full-time job to represent myself pro se in a custody case. Oh, I bet it is, because you don't know what the hell you're doing.
Right.
So
that's why there's professional attorneys out there.
Come on.
Family law is a big business. And then this is
sympathy,
the best. This
the
is when it gets a little political, because she asked him about being a millennial, and he interpreted that as being a flaming liberal.
I would say that I'm really not a member of that demographic that they're speaking to, of that group. I'm a very conservative person. The millennials that they're speaking to are very liberal in their ideology.
But you're 30, so technically I think you are part of the millennial generation. I don't think there's a delineation between...
You're right. When people speak to the millennials and their general nature as a millennial, they speak to more liberal leanings, in my opinion. Do you disagree?
I don't think it's for me to disagree. I think a millennial is a millennial is a millennial based upon the year that you were born.
Okay.
But I think it's totally your opinion to say, you know, that doesn't apply to me. And with that, Michael Rotundo, I appreciate you coming on. I truly wish you the best of luck. And
I am a millennial.
Okay.
Yes. All Michael. Right. Thanks.
Great.
She treated like he's a 5-year-old boy. Yes, Michael.
Who are? That Don Lemon interview.
Brooke Baldwin.
Oh, whatever. Brooke Baldwin. She's as dumb as he is.
Gorgeous.
What the hell is she talking about?
Well, it's hard. You're talking to a man child. They're not easy to interview.
And she's talking to he's talking to a woman child, apparently, arguing about what a millennial constitutes. By the way, just Michael. Yeah.
Oh, yes. Advice from Dan Prof parenting tips.
Well, this is not a difficult call, but we're not really that interested in claiming you as one of the conservative millennials.
Yes.
So at least not until we see 2 months of pay stubs. But, you know, hey, our technical producer, Justin, has a Michael Rotundo in the basement of his ancestral home.
His brother, 27 years old, has been living in the basement for 4 years, won't get a job. Nobody likes him. Nobody talks to him.
So, Justin, does he have litigation pending against Best Buy as well? We can't hear Justin.
You. Oh, he controls the board.
You got to turn the mic on. He's our technical producer.
Oh, things are getting technical. But yeah, he lives in the. We're all like,
There we go.
There it is.
Hi. So tell us about your brother.
He worked at Target. It wasn't not a lot.
It's always big box stores involved in this.
Maybe a couple hours a week, and then it became no hours a week. And
2 hours is a lot.
Oh, but he still had a job, everybody claimed, and soon he didn't have a job. And it's been 3 years now, and just living in the basement, hanging out, enjoying life, playing
games. Well,
do
your parents pay for his cell phone?
They pay
food?
For everything.
See, that's the problem. You got to cut it off.
Well, wait, what does he do? He's
a gamer.
He's a gamer?
Big Fortnite? Gamer. I don't know about Fortnite. I see, I try to stay away from him.
Oh.
Does he know Michael Rotundo by any chance?
It could be buddies.
Why hasn't he worked in 3 years? He just doesn't have the time for it? It interferes with his gaming schedule? Or
gaming, and he claims he's disabled, but there's no proof of any ailment that would cause him not to work.
Wow.
Does he get benefits of any sort?
He's getting something from somewhere, I'm not sure, but it's always thrown back in our face from his mom, who tries to defend him. Oh, he gives me $150 every month. You guys don't give us anything, but $150 comes from where? Because you don't work.
Does he? Is he hanging around with like a high school chemistry professor, and they go to like a mobile home for hours on end, and then...
You know, that would at least be productive.
Oh, yeah,
so
sure.
Does he even leave the house ever?
No. He leaves the house to get food, or sometimes people bring him food.
And he's one of these guys, like it seems Michael Rotundo's, he's just impervious to shame.
Oh,
there's no shaming him.
No shame whatsoever.
God,
you're going to have to evict him soon. Or he'll die in that house.
Well, I mean,
he'll stay there for decades.
He just got off his mom's insurance, to be fair. I mean, so.
Mommy's still paying the insurance to some extent, though.
I'm sure he's
I'm sure. But I mean, he's 27. He's barely an adult. 26 is the new threshold for adulthood. So, I mean, he's just sort of starting his life in adulthood. Does he have any skill sets other than the gaming? Nothing discernible.
Hanging out.
Nothing discernible.
Gosh. I don't want to go over to your house ever.
This is this is sort of an epidemic.
It is a problem. And I have a family member who just encouraged their son to get out. And I said, well,
how old was he?
25.
Yeah, that's pretty young.
I hope he's going to make it.
25.
I mean, at least make him pay for his own cell phone bill.
I think I'm going to go the other way. I think stay-at-home sons should be a designation and a protected class.
Oh, don't now. See, now you've done it.
That's what they should do. They should organize.
They should organize.
Michael Rotundo can be the business
union leader,
manager.
I
mean, he was, you know, he's got some business math education, right? Couldn't cut it in engineering, so he's got some of that business math. You know, just could take on Justin's brother.
Well, I think it's a bigger problem than we know.
Wow. Boy, Michael Rotundo has really done a public service, hasn't he?
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer.
I'm like, go.
Text from Ann B. Davis's bowling ball. He doesn't have a job, Michael Rotundo, but I guarantee you he has a sweet collection of nunchucks. Cindy and Joliet, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, hi, good morning. I have to laugh at this because my kids are 26 and 28 years old, and they both have college degrees, and they're, you know, they're successful in their own right in their early careers. But when I decided to cut the cord and begin the process, which it is a process, the phones were the first to go. And I told them, I said, you know, here's what's going to happen. I'm not paying this anymore. You know, next month you're done, so make arrangements to figure out how you're going to get your own phone bill paid. Well, my daughter, you know, she's like working on her JD back then, and she says, that's not fair because, she's referring to her brother, he got his phone plan 2 years longer than I did. You paid for his. It's not fair that you cut me off now because you paid 2 years more for him. I said, hey, that's the luck of the draw, you know, life's tough, get a helmet. And they were furious. I said, well, here's the deal. If you meet me at the Verizon store on the given day, whatever it was, and I said, that's the day of the switch, and if you're not there, you're going to lose your phone number, which means you lose your contact and everything, because I technically own the number per what Verizon told me. And I said, that's your choice. I said, there's no other choice, and you're done. I said, you can start your whole phone list over. Your pictures are gone, whatever. I said, I can't afford you anymore.
Yeah.
So... and they were old enough. I mean,
well, I don't know why parents don't just drop these kids off in the forest somewhere and say, you know, if you can find your way back to the house, then we'll talk. I mean, I think they're more draconian measures need to be taken than to the phone. Thanks for the call, Cindy.
It does work.
Holly and Hudson.
Hey, good morning, you two. Dan, you were awesome the other day at the City Club.
Oh, thank you.
Anyway, listen, I have three kids. I've raised them in the middle of nowhere, Central Illinois. We did not own a video console. They never grew up playing video games. My mantra was go outside and play. This is a non-negotiable contract with my children. When you graduate from college, the day afterwards, you are responsible to earn a living wage. This is a one-way trip, college, out on your own, non-negotiable, black and white. Everybody knows it in advance, and that's the bottom line. The problem that I see is that none of their peers have the same responsibility attached to their college education. So everyone else is getting a degree in Lazy River, and my kids are struggling through engineering degrees at the Naval Academy and at U of I, and it's the peer pressure of actually having to be accountable once they graduate.
Well, your kids, that'll work out better for them than their colleagues. Thanks for the call, Holly, and the parenting tip.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, you think of the great tandems. You think...
Dan and Amy.
You think Peaches and Herb. You think Ashford and Simpson. You think...
Starsky and Hutch.
You think Cagney and Lacey. You think...
Thelma and Louise.
You think Hardcastle and McCormick.
Ernie and Bert.
Bert and Ernie.
No, it's Ernie and Bert.
No, it's Bert and Ernie.
Oh, no.
Well, I mean, everybody has their preferences. Sure. That's what makes the cop, particularly the buddy films.
Yeah.
Particularly the buddy cop films. So, enjoy. You think Step Brothers?
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Now I have to see that film because we've talked about it so many times this week because of that.
That is the anthem of
kid.
The Michael Rotundos of the world. There's no question. But I give you perhaps the greatest tandem of them all, Clapper and Tapper. And
Clapper, Tapper, Clapper, Tapper, the Clapper, Tapper.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
Thank you.
You stole that from Tony on the South Side.
I sure did.
You've got to give attribution. It's okay. Tony on the South Side, also the innovator who gave us Tangerine Jesus for Trump. Jim Clapper is in the midst of a book tour. We've been through this before with his colleague, Jim Comey. And President Trump, before he jetted off to a conference on MS-13 to discuss the sparks of divinity that those young rapscallions possess, addressed before the D.C. press corps some of what Clapper has been saying and some of what Comey has been saying as well on the matter of spying on the Trump campaign.
Looks like a very serious event, but we'll find out. When they look at the documents, I think people are going to see a lot of bad things happen. I hope it's not so, because if it is, there's never been anything like it in the history of our country. I hope, I mean, if you look at Clapper, he sort of admitted that they had spies in the campaign yesterday, inadvertently. But I hope it's not true, but it looks like it is. I think James Comey's got a lot of problems. If you look at what he did, if you look at all of the lies, the tremendous lies, if you look at all that's going on, I think James Comey's got a lot of problems. Now, at some point, they have an IG report, and then let's see what James Comey has to say. But I assume he's covered in the IG report. But if you look at what he said, all of the lies, all of the fiction, I think he's got a lot of problems.
So, I think the president might be onto something.
And he gave it a new name. It's called Spygate.
We now call it Spygate.
Spygate.
So Clapper was asked about Spygate when he sat down with his buddy Tapper and what the president had to say about Clapper.
Did the intelligence community spy on President Trump and his campaign?
No, we did not. And that is a distortion of what I said. In fact, I had an aversion to the use of the term, and I thought I made that clear. And the important thing is here, what was this all about? Well, what it was about was trying to determine what the Russians were doing. Were they trying to gain access, infiltrate a political campaign? Didn't matter which campaign. And it had nothing to do with spying on the campaign per se. It was about the Russians, which is what we should all be concerned about, to include President Trump.
Of course, and to the extent that there was one or more spies that were dispatched to the Trump campaign in some material fashion, it was all quite benign.
This is a very benign thing that where he engaged directly with two or three people about, and again, trying to glean insight into what might the Russians be doing here to gain access to the campaign.
You know what's interesting about Clapper, like his buddy Comey, like so many of these guys, is they speak with authority on what was happening. Mm-hmm. While at the same time suggesting they don't know what was happening. It was, you know, beyond their area of authority. So Clapper said, I didn't know about Stefan Halper, you know, because I'm not supposed to know. I'm not supposed to know about FBI informants. There are specific protocols. When he was asked about Michael Caputo's contention that another agent of another federal agency made a run at him, and he's hoping, by the way, we're going to have Caputo on Friday, tomorrow.
Yay, tomorrow. Good.
But then he's waiting for clearance from his attorney to provide the details there. Clapper said, well, I don't know if that happened. It's possible that it happened. I don't know. That would be beyond my authority to have that knowledge. So I don't know what the FBI was doing. I don't know the assets they were employing. But I definitely know what did and didn't happen with respect to surveilling the Trump campaign. I know what the objective was. I know the kind of broad outlines of the mission, even though I don't really know because I'm not supposed to know the means and methods. I can speak with authority here, even though I don't know kind of the underlying basis to draw these conclusions. It's really frustrating. And here's something that's even more frustrating. In his book, Clapper's new book.
Yeah.
That
what's the title of it?
Facts and Fears.
Oh.
Which he should have done.
Facts and Fears.
He should have done what? With Tapper. I mean, he did this alone. I hate when, you know, tandems break up. He writes, does Clapper, of course the Russian effort affected the outcome. Surprising even themselves, they swung the election to a Trump win. That is an astounding claim that nobody has made. The former director of national intelligence, who Trump has referred to as the world's dumbest director of national intelligence, right. He is saying what nobody in the Obama administration has said. Nobody else, even in the intelligence community, said.
All the Russian did was buy some Facebook ads.
He is concluding that the Russian interference in the election was definitive for Trump without basis. It's remarkable to listen to these guys.
It's irresponsible. But only that. But go to CNN or watch MSNBC. All they're saying is that Trump believes that he had a Russian spy because it's being said so on Fox. And they even put this montage together.
The spying they did on the Trump campaign. I'm shocked to hear that they put a spy in the campaign.
Spy inside the Trump campaign, back to the FBI.
FBI spies, or maybe two spies.
It looks as if there could have been a second spy.
These spy revelations.
Yeah, what's the point?
They said there's no proof that there's a spy, and that President Trump is making this up, like making up that 3 million people voted illegally.
What did President Trump just say? What did he just say yesterday? Let's play it again.
Yeah. Looks like a very serious event, but we'll find out.
Well, and if the FBI paid this person, Stephen Halpern, to spy on the campaign, then why? I just don't understand why they don't think it's a spy.
Stephen Halper, name assassinator. Yeah, he was paid $400,000 through September, north of that, through September of 17.
We're in the wrong business.
When the FISA warrant on Carter Page expired. And Tapper, despite the fact that they're working on some buddy projects together, at least he probed Clapper a bit when he suggested, well, okay, so they're there. So Stephen Halper is there to interdict any efforts for Russian interference. Well, doesn't that also necessitate surveilling, a.k.a. spying on Trump campaign operatives? And, Clapper kind of danced around that. Mm-hmm. But, he just, if you say things in a room temperature tone of voice with the amplification of the D.C. press corps, outrageous things, outrageous statements completely unfounded, like swung the election to a Trump win, the Russians did. That is Clapper's claim.
It's irresponsible. 312-642-5600 is our turnkey Dow Pro answer line.
Steve in Evanston, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hi. What I want to know is then, why wasn't the next question to Clapper, well, who did you have in Hillary's campaign?
Right. Right. And
that's the next question. That's what blows that whole thing apart.
Well, but,
you know?
Thanks for the call, Steve. But here's the thing. So Steve raised a good point. This has been raised by others. We talked about it a little bit yesterday. But right, exactly. So if you're protecting, you're going to protect both sides. Clapper and the other slime merchants in D.C. peddling these stories have essentially said two things. One, I don't know that it could have been, because remember, Clapper doesn't know. He didn't know about Halper. He doesn't know if there were other assets dispatched to the Trump campaign. He doesn't know. Maybe there were to the Hillary campaign, too, because he doesn't know means and methods, but he still knows what the conclusion should be. Hmm. And then number two, the argument is, well, the intelligence community knew that Russia was looking to pump up Trump and diminish Hillary, and so that's why the Trump campaign was their focus. That's the two-pronged rationale you get back. George in Libertyville.
Hey, guys. This is these criminals, these liars, literally get to walk among us as they're continuing to do what they do and say what they say, these outrageous things. So, Dan, my question is, what, in your opinion, what has to happen, literally, for a guy like Clapper to either get so cornered that he pleads or he goes to prison?
Well, thanks for the call, George. I mean, you have to, Clapper specifically, I don't know. I don't know what he knew or didn't know, what he did or didn't do, but it sure seems like a concerted effort among guys at the top of the law enforcement and intel agencies during the Obama administration to, frankly, interfere with the election, to borrow a phrase. And so the suggestion that Brennan and Comey have both perjured themselves under oath. What has to happen for there to be accountability at the highest levels in our federal government? Well, you have to have an example of somebody actually being held accountable. The low-hanging fruit, the rank and file, are routinely held accountable. But somehow these guys on book tours get away with it. So pull. Well,
they're just pushing their agenda, and they're trying to sell books and line their pockets.
But if there is substantial evidence that somebody committed a crime,
then we should know about it.
And the only way to re-inspire confidence in the federal government and these agencies is to pull one of these guys who may have committed a crime, if there's evidence to support it, off their book tour and put them in prison. That's the way. Mike in Park Ridge.
Hi. I just for full disclosure, I was not a Trump supporter, but I don't think the Russian Facebook tiny little ads had that much impact, if any, on the election.
Yeah.
What swung the election, in my opinion, was the 2016 midsummer Dallas massacre of five or six police officers while they were protecting the rights of people to exercise their First Amendment rights. That was a big event. That was not fake news. That really happened.
Yeah, right. Thanks for the call, Mike. Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, that was an important event in terms of framing the law and order aspect of the campaign. But I mean, it's always difficult, especially a race that close, to isolate. I mean, is it Hillary not going to Wisconsin or Michigan?
Then her putting a rope around herself so reporters couldn't talk to her during a parade. I mean, she was a horrible, horrible candidate.
Right. So how they handled all the email stuff, how they handled all of the revelations about her leveraging the Secretary of State's office for personal enrichment. I mean, it's the ceteris paribus thing. Holding everything else equal, this was definitive. It's difficult to, say this is what definitely swung the election to Trump. I mean, of course, a lot of Democrats argue it was Comey opening up that email investigation 2 weeks out, right? Wiener's computer and all that. Neil in the Western suburbs.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. What people don't remember is the Snowden revelations about the three hop rule. And so with a FISA warrant, all they had to do was get one warrant on Carter Page. And then from there, they could take it three hops out. And I think if you look through the Snowden documents that he revealed, it could be a lot of people. So you could pretty much surveil the whole campaign with just one warrant. And that's from the Snowden documents.
Thanks, Neil.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You've switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
You want more than just the headlines? Find out what's going on and what it means with me, Dennis Prager, this morning at 11, right here on AM 560, The Answer.
Just a little housekeeping. I think I've got the inventory so far. We're trying to establish the best buddy tandem since. Clapper and Tapper are the best buddy tandem since.
Since. Starsky and Hutch.
I got Peaches and Herb. I got Hardcastle McCormick. I got Starsky and Hutch. I got Turner and Hooch. I got Campton and Tennille. I got Tango and Cash. I got Larry and Balky. I got Criss Cross. I got Ashford and Simpson.
Oh, okay.
I got Laverne and Shirley. I got Cagney and Lacey. All right. So if you want to add to our list so that we can determine.
Shamil Shamazel Hops Around Incorporated.
There you go. The best buddy tandem, Clapper and Tapper, the best buddy tandem since, because obviously we want to market this, want to see them on the silver screen and so forth after Clapper's performance with Tapper yesterday on CNN. But now we have to talk a little economics and help
big
us do that.
This morning.
We're pleased to be joined by our friend, Heritage Foundation economist, CNN senior economist, Wall Street Journal columnist, many other titles. He is
all
Steve
around
Moore.
Good guy.
Yeah, there's another title. Steve Moore joins us. Steve, welcome.
Oh, boy.
Steve.
Lennon McCartney.
Oh, hey, Steve. Oh, I'm sorry. What did you say?
How about Lennon McCartney? How about Cudlow Moore?
Cudlow Moore. Ooh, yeah. But, I mean,
buddies. I mean, the guy was the best man at my wedding. So, I mean, we're pretty good buddies.
Oh,
Sonny and Cher.
Sonny and Cher.
Sonny and Cher,
guys,
an obvious one. Donnie and Marie.
Donnie and Marie, another good one.
Tony and Tennille.
You guys are good.
Tony Antonio.
Captain Antonio. I already mentioned.
Hey, watch out, Amy. You're dating yourself here.
Yeah. And you and Kudlow will have to either make music together or solve crimes in order to be considered on the list.
Seals and Croft.
Seals and Croft. That's another good one.
Oh, yeah.
All right. We'll take them all morning. So this news that just as we're starting to walk away from a trade imbroglio with China, the Trump administration is considering imposing new tariffs on foreign vehicles and auto parts, as much as 25% on automobile imports. What say you to that idea, Steve Moore?
Yikes. I just saw that news flash. I guess he tweeted that out, right?
Yes.
This morning. No, I don't like it. You know, I'm not a tariff guy. Now, we've had this conversation on this show before. I'm very much in favor of getting tough with China because I think China is a real problem on the world stage. They cheat, they steal, they're arming our enemies. But the idea of just a blanket tariff on autos is a tax on consumers. It will make America less competitive. And it's a special interest, you know, gift to the American auto producers at the cost of consumers. So that idea. I'm writing my column on this week, and this is why we have Larry Kudlow over at the White House to try to walk him down off the cliff on this stuff.
Well, why would he even want to implement these tariffs to begin with? Doesn't he think this through? I mean, really, Germany VW is not happy right now, and Japan automakers are not happy right now.
Yep. Why does he want to do it? Well, look, I do think his heart is in the right place. I think he does care about those blue-collar manufacturing jobs in places like Michigan and Ohio and states like that. I think he's trying to, quote, protect their jobs, but it's just a policy that's never worked. I mean, you make cars more expensive here, you make auto parts more expensive, that may actually, in the end, end up hurting our auto industry. And, a lot of those foreign cars, by the way, they're actually made in the United States.
Sure.
I mean, you go throughout the South, this, Dan. I mean, you go to Texas and Alabama and South Carolina, and all you see is Toyota plants and Nissan plants. And, a lot of those cars are made in the United States. It's a dumb policy, and I hope that Trump retreats from it.
Well, do you think this is just another play of saber-rattling, of trying to leverage for, as Larry Kudlow has said about the back and forth with China, right? Ultimately, it's a medium-term growth play to reduce barriers on both sides, and this is his way of trying to back competitors
down.
Yes,
of course. That's what the game he's playing. But look, we don't import that many cars from China, right? We import cars from Japan and Germany and some of the cars are made in Mexico and so on. But look, I'm in favor of using the threat of some of these tariffs against countries like China that are abusing the trade laws. Now, the president's own Council of Economic Advisors came out with a report that was actually pretty startling about how much higher the tariffs are that other countries are imposing against us than we impose against them. And these are countries, in many cases, that we have trade agreements with, and they're just not abiding by the trade deals. And so, I like the idea of Trump saying, hey, play by the rules here. If we're going to open up our markets to you and buy your cars, you got to buy our soybeans and blue jeans and bourbon and things like that. So that I'm fine with that, using the threat of punitive tariffs, unless these other countries start reducing their trade barriers. But I don't see the point of just a I bet half the people listening to the show right now are in a foreign-made car.
No question. And this co-host being one of them.
I'm in an American one.
What are you driving
driven
these days? Well, you're not a Ford or Chevy girl?
I'm talking about me.
Oh, you're talking about you. Yeah. You drive a Mercedes.
Yeah.
Okay.
I drive an American car made in America.
There you go.
Yeah.
Yeah, you cut Amy. She bleeds red, white, and blue.
There's no question about that. But going back to China, though.
I always wondered about your patriotism, Dan.
That's exactly. I'm a subversive.
He kneels during the national anthem.
Yeah, right. China, though, Steve, I want to ask you about the reports of, the possibility of a compromise deal to prop up the big big Chinese telecom company ZTE in exchange for reduced barriers for agricultural products from America to China. What do you think of that?
You know, the last week or so, Trump has had not had a good week on the trade front because, you know, I would refer your listeners to a great editorial the other day in the Wall Street Journal. I think it was about last Saturday or something, where they basically said, wait a minute. First, we say we're going to impose tariffs on China, and they retaliate and say, okay, well, then we're going to impose higher tariffs on your, you know, soybeans and your beef. And then Trump said, oh, no, don't do that. You know, we'll cancel these penalties against this subversive company, ZTE, if you don't impose these tariffs on our pork. And it's like, wait a minute, what have you accomplished here? So it looked to me like Trump blinked a little bit here. And ZTE is a subversive company. There's no question about it. They've been involved in espionage and things like that, stealing our technology. And so this looked like a retreat to me from Trump. And so I think it was a mistake to lift the sanctions against ZTE. And, you know, look, China's going to, if I'm Trump, I just simply say, look, in, you know, 90 days or 100 days, whatever it is, we're going to impose this tariff on you unless you stop cheating, stop stealing our technology. I mean, this is a big deal, folks. I mean, this is $300 to $500 billion a year they're stealing from us, you know, and we can't live with that any longer. But look, the ZTE thing, I think, was a strategic mistake. And now, like, China seems to be thinking, well, gee, all we have to do is threaten the United States with tariffs on certain things they want to sell to us, and then they'll back down. So it was not a good strategy by Trump.
Congress voted to roll back Dodd-Frank, and President Trump's going to sign that soon. So what does that mean for common folks like myself?
Well, that's a good question. Now, this is what we wanted, you know, when I was working for Trump on the campaign. Of course, we campaigned on the total repeal of Dodd-Frank. It's a terrible bill. And one of the things it's done is it's let, you know, there's a rule in Washington called the law of unintended consequences, where oftentimes these laws do exactly the opposite of what we hope. And incidentally, I got to step back and just say, can you imagine two worst people in the entire United States to write a financial regulation bill than Chris Dodd and Barney Frank? I mean,
exactly.
these were the arsonists. These were the people who started the fire, and then we asked them to fix it. I mean, Barney Frank, literally 2 months before the entire mortgage market collapsed, was the one, you remember this, Dan, remember, said, I like to roll the dice on the housing market. And we rolled the dice, and it came up cat's eyes, and we all got destroyed by that. So,
well, that's why
there's
That's why I don't buy the unintended consequences here with those two knuckleheads,
Dodd and Frank.
Maybe
this was intended consequences because what we got, as you guys know, is we got a further consolidation of the banking industry so that the big, big, powerful banks got even bigger. Look at Wells Fargo and Citi and so on today. And the smaller community banks couldn't deal with the regulations. There's a little bit of an economics lesson here that oftentimes the big guys, the big entrenched powers, they want regulation. You know why? Because they can deal with the regulations. It's the small upstart companies that are nipping at their heels that can't absorb the costs. And this is a perfect example of that.
I want to get your take on your friends over at Goldman Sachs, their fiscal outlook for the country this year, this week, I should say. Yeah, exactly. I say that sarcastically. But their fiscal outlook for the country is not good, and it's not good because of projected ballooning federal deficits. How did you react to that estimate?
It's ridiculous. I mean, these people are on planet Jupiter. I mean, look, the numbers just came out. I'm writing a column with Art Laffer right now, sneak preview, that you know how much the revenues were up in April? Federal tax revenues over last year. You want to take a wild guess? What percent?
14%.
You're pretty close. 12.5%. 12.5% is the biggest monthly increase that we've had in like 15 years. Wait a minute. We cut taxes and we're getting more revenues? I think I said that this might happen on this show. I mean, 12.5%. That means we got a record inflow of tax revenues into the federal treasury in April. 12.5% above that alone. That 1 month increase in the revenues increases the baseline. We've just cut the cost of the deficit by half. I mean, instead of being a $2 trillion tax, it's now $1 trillion tax. By the way, Goldman Sachs, they've got a lot of nerve. I mean, this is a company, every time we have these bailouts and all of these kinds of policies, you know, in terms of crisis, what company always comes out smelling like a rose?
Goldman Sachs, CAIG. No, I agree with you about the messenger, but in terms of the message, what about the spend side? $1.3 trillion omnibus spending.
Problem.
So that's you know, you can generate all the revenue in the world if they're spending more than all the revenue in the world.
Yeah, but the point is that's absolutely right, and I think the spending is despicable and it's indefensible. But here's the point: did you guys look at the? Yeah, but you didn't. There's a Atlanta Federal Reserve Bank report that came out this week. What do you think that the growth rate is so far for the second quarter of 2018?
The GDP growth?
Yeah, 4.1%.
Over 4%.
This economy.
Another Steve Moore prediction.
If you get 4% growth, and we get 2 or 3 years of 4% growth, those we get so much revenue in, the deficit goes down, it doesn't go up. End of story. This is exactly what we predicted. Kudlow, Laffer, Forbes, Moore, we had the story exactly right, and I ain't backing off on it. I love the story. And you know what, guys? I'm almost getting tired of winning.
Steve Moore, Wall Street Journal columnist, chief economist for CNN and the Heritage Foundation. Steve, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
All right, guys. Have a great week.
Take care.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. It's sort of an odd question against the backdrop of historically low unemployment, but is there a war on work? A war on work. I know it's being waged by one man in upstate New York named Michael Rotundo.
He's too busy to get a job.
By the way, Ann B. Davis's Bowling Ball tweeted a visual of his belief of what Michael Rotundo's room looks like. He compared it to like a picture search in Highlights magazine. Half eaten filet of fish.
Yeah.
Best Buy name tag, nunchucks, Carlton Sheets VHS set. Sure. No money down real estate. I love hot moms t-shirt.
I love hot moms.
and a partially completed FBI application. I think that really sets the room. I think maybe NB Davis' bowling ball has been in Michael Rotundo's room because that is eerily accurate. That does it for me. Rotundo surfaced from the basement yesterday to take to the airwaves to rally for the cause of tenancy rights for other stay-at-home sons. But before we get to him, I want to pull from this Mike Rowe, Dirty Jobs, you know, Mike Rowe, Dirty Jobs and Discovery Ship, right? He gave a TED Talk, and he talked about what he thinks is the war on work from traveling the globe and, you know, doing his Dirty Job show and actually being engaged with people doing these everyday jobs that are not glamorous but quite necessary and in some cases quite lucrative but not glamorous.
I love Mike Rowe.
The war on work. Listen to what Mike Rowe had to say.
I have formed a theory, and I'm going to share it now in my remaining 2 minutes and 30 seconds. It goes like this. We've declared war on work as a society, all of us. It's a civil war. It's a cold war, really. We didn't set out to do it, and we didn't twist our mustache in some Machiavellian way, but we've done it. And we have waged this war on at least four fronts, certainly in Hollywood. The way we portray working people on TV, it's laughable. If there's a plumber, he's 300 pounds and he's got a giant butt crack, admit it. You've seen him all the time. That's what plumbers look like, right? We turn them into heroes or we turn them into punchlines. That's what TV does. We try hard on Dirty Jobs not to do that, which is why I do the work and I don't cheat. But we've waged this war on Madison Avenue. I mean, so many of the commercials that come out there in the way of a message, what's really being said? Your life would be better if you could work a little less, if you didn't have to work so hard, if you could get home a little earlier, if you could retire a little faster, if you could punch out a little sooner. It's all in there over and over again and again. Washington, I can't even begin to talk about the deals and policies in place that affect the bottom line reality of the available jobs, because I don't really know. I just know that that's a front in this war. And right here, guys, Silicon Valley. I mean, how many people have an iPhone on them right now? How many people have their Blackberries on? We're plugged in. We're connected. I would never suggest for a second that something bad has come out of the tech revolution. Good grief, not to this crowd. But I would suggest that innovation without imitation is a complete waste of time. And nobody celebrates imitation the way Dirty Jobs guys know it has to be done. Your iPhone without those people making the same interface, the same circuitry, the same board over and over, all that, you know, that's what makes it equally as possible as the genius that goes inside of it. So we've got this new toolbox, you know. Our tools today don't look like shovels and picks. They look like the stuff we walk around with. And so the collective effect of all of that has been this marginalization of lots and lots of jobs.
Is Mike Rowe right about the war on work, the marginalization of jobs? This is part of, I think, what President Trump ran. It's part of what we're going to talk about with our guest at 8:35, Montez King from Trump's Task Force on Apprenticeship Expansion. But does he have a point about that? We de-glamorize unglamorous work. And again, you talk to small to mid-sized manufacturers, you talk to people in a lot of sectors, the trades, and they have a real difficult time finding quality workers, filling good jobs, good paying jobs, jobs that are important but not glamorous, that provide, you know, sort of the foundation on which some of those innovations that Mike Rowe referenced are built.
But it's weird. It's like nobody wants to work.
Right.
Nobody wants to pay for their own housing. Nobody wants to move out of the mom's house. Nobody wants to have their cell phone bill. It's them stop paying their cell phone bills.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. I guess that's a nice transition to our friend, the Great Rotundo.
The Great Rotundo, we've learned that college was too hard. That's why he dropped out. He was in a community college, was an engineer. The math was too hard. Then he went into business, but he couldn't even do that. Too hard. Just dropped out, moved back home, worked at a Best Buy, but they wouldn't give him off on Saturdays, and that's when he would see his son. So he is suing them for discrimination for $340,000, and that's where he thinks he's going to get his bread buttered.
Why don't you just move out of your parents' house, like tomorrow?
I don't have the means to do that tomorrow.
Okay.
So,
do you have a job?
No.
Are you trying to get a job? Because I read that one of the things your parents asked of you, there are jobs available even for those with a poor work history like you. Get one. You have to work. Are you working on that?
I have plans to be able to provide myself with the income I need to support myself, but it's not something that's going to come together tomorrow. So I'm trying to do what's best for me, and I do want to leave, and I want to leave as soon as possible. But it's not tomorrow. I don't think it should have to be tomorrow.
But you want it to be tomorrow. It just isn't tomorrow because you don't have the means yet to make it tomorrow.
But he's working on it, and he's got the suit against Best Buy. And this is sort of what I think Mike Rowe was referring to when he talked about, I can't even begin to discuss the policies emanating out of Washington. And you could say the same thing about state capitals, particularly state capitals in states with big urban centers like New York, Illinois, California. And what is this Rotundo doing? He's working. He's working on an angle. He's working on a lawsuit against Best Buy, some flimsy claim of discrimination because they wouldn't give him Saturdays off, and that's we're stipulating his version of events, which of course I generally would not. But let's just say that what he's saying is true. So it's about gaming the system because government is so overarching, particularly in the workplace. That the play is not to work in advance of producing a product or providing a service. The play is the rent-seeking play. How do I scam the system to get an undeserved benefit, perhaps even an undeserved windfall? We see this all the time. I mean, this is what, you know, most plaintiffs' attorneys are in the business of.
Well, now Best Buy is in the public eye because of this, and who knows if they're just going to settle with him because of all this.
Yeah, but the point is scamming the system.
Yeah, he is scamming. He's scamming his parents, too.
When government is as big as it is and has all these goodies to hand out, people work, but they work to work the system.
Well, look at Justin's brother, not to bring that back up, or somebody on our shows, you know, they're on some type of disability, you know, and that feels like it's scamming the system. Now, I don't know all the details of that, but there's a lot of people out there who scam the system.
You create a rent-seeking culture when you have government this big at the federal level and the state level. And that, so it's... I mean, again, you think, what's the labor participation rate? Just north of 62%? So there's a lot of people that aren't counted as unemployed or even necessarily U6 rate underemployed because they're not looking for work. They're fine playing the angles the system provides to earn as much doing nothing except scamming the system as they could if they got an entry-level job and then tried to work their way up over time. That's an important part of this conversation about the war on work that's not discussed enough, and thus you have actual productive enterprises that can't find productive people to fill open slots.
Well, Rotondo, he said he knew he was in trouble when his parents stopped paying his cell phone bill, and they wouldn't let him do laundry there. So he has to take his laundry.
That was his first tip off. It wasn't
the five notes or the conversations. I mean,
it wasn't the fact that he's 30 years old and he's living in his parents' basement. And he's got an 8-year-old son.
Yeah,
that didn't tip him off.
Well, he lost custody of his son, and the parents are like, "If you ever want to see your son, you're going to have to get a job and have health care so you could provide for him."
All right. Well, stay-at-home sons of the world unite.
Call in, or if you have a kid at home.
Nothing to lose but your PlayStation.
You need advice from Dan Proft on Proft Parenting Tips on how to kick them out. We're here for you, 312-642-5600.
James in Westmont, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Oh, geez. Well, like I do agree with Mike Rowe about the war on work. I mean, in my field, we do have a hard time finding people. But just watching that guy, Rotondo, it just calls to me the Godfather movie where Vito Corleone smacks his godson in the face and tells him to act like a man and quit crying like a woman because this guy, you know, wherever he was down in his luck or whatever like that. And I could see myself being Vito, and that guy obviously is Johnny Fontaine, and you, Dan, will be Tom Hagen laughing in the corner.
Thanks for the casting, James. I appreciate
it. This guy feels so entitled, too. That's what really bothers me. Like, he doesn't even remotely think that what he was doing was wrong.
He's been conditioned. I mean, he literally is. He's like, it's like being conditioned by the state. He's just been conditioned by his family to be a dependent and a victim.
And you don't think this is going to start a movement of parents getting their kids evicted from their homes?
Or a movement of stay-at-home sons and daughters to, lay claim to their tenancy rights, I guess. And more government benefits. David and McCook. Sorry.
Hey, good morning, guys. First of all, it doesn't look like Rotondo does his laundry.
Oh, wait. Hold on a second. Hold on. David and McCook. Sorry. Start again.
Good morning, guys. I was just saying, first of all, it doesn't look like the Rotondo guy doesn't do his laundry very often.
Because of what I said yesterday, he had the burgundy dress shirt on.
That was probably a dead
giveaway.
Short sleeved.
Yeah. Created out in 1972. Democrats created this problem because every time you hear of a Republican trying to put work requirements on welfare, it's like a huge taboo subject. Oh, shame on you. How dare you ask people to work? They're already down and out.
Yeah, thanks for the call, David. Lee and Hammond.
Yeah, guys. I remember years ago, Studs Terkel wrote that book, Working, and the one thing you took away from that was that, I mean, he interviewed people from all different kind of, I mean, everything from hookers to cops to bakers to presidents of banks to steel workers.
Yeah.
And one thing that came through in all of it was the pride and self-respect people got in what they did. No matter what it was that they were out there in some kind of trade doing whatever just to try to survive in this world, and they took pride in it. And I think that pride is gone. There's a real lack of self-respect in this society.
You know what else?
Everybody just wants to skate.
Yeah, you know what else you took away from Socialist Terkel's book, Working? You know what else you took away?
What?
He's a terrible writer. Thanks for the call, Lee. That was the other thing you took away. Kirby in Racine County.
Hey, Dan and Amy. I actually just got off work working third shift as a maintenance electrician. Okay. I got my start back in the Navy so many years ago. I'm 47. I have a 17-year-old son who lives down in Georgia. And one thing that I'm trying to teach to him, I'd love him to go to college, but he needs to learn a trade. Mm-hmm. I fully support with what Mike Rowe is doing. And a lot of it falls on the parents motivating their kids to not just do college, but do something that is useful and that can be applied to anywhere should you not be able to get your college degree.
Right.
Thanks for the call, Kirby. Appreciate it. Good perspective there. Dan and Joliet.
Oh, thank you for taking my phone call. Love you guys. In a way, I just think the situation is very complex. Dan, I mean, I come from the same, you know, Catholic background that you come from, pretty close. And I have been blessed my whole life to be in a union, whether it's when I was in high school or now that I'm an adult. I'm not like a pro, you know, like crazy union person, but, you know, 40 years ago, I worked at a major grocery chain. It closed. I was making $7.50 an hour. My son, last week, got hired by a major grocery chain. He's making minimum wage. 40 years later, it just seems like we're going backwards a lot. All these forklift jobs, all these, you know, like big warehouses, they pay people like $11, $12 an hour in order to make it in this country. It's just, I think it's unsustainable. You know, we're getting paid some of the wages that these young kids get paid now.
Well, okay, thanks for the call, Dan. The only thing I'd say is, I mean, I was just mentioning in the manufacturing sector. I mean, you have small, mid-sized manufacturers that have jobs operating their digital lathes and other machinery these days on the factory floor, where they're willing to train somebody who comes to the table with a good work ethic, even if they, you know, don't have the initial skill sets to operate some of this machine. They're willing to pay to train because they're so desperate for people with the right work ethic to add value to, you know, their production line. And you're talking about jobs that, you know, maybe start out at 50, 60 and go to six figures.
My first job in TV, I made $10,500 a year. I had to live.
Yeah, but that was in 1946.
No, I had to live. No, it was in 1991. And I had, so you have to, you buy ramen noodles. You work hard then on your career to get to a better job. I lived in a closet. I'm not kidding you. I lived in a closet, and I shared a bathroom and a kitchen with people down the hallway. That was fun.
All right. Here's the other side of the coin. Is a non-college graduate who did not go on to success in life, Sean from Elmwood Park.
That is not true. Hi, Sean.
Yeah. And worked in a union and saw it for what it is, a con, a scam, American communism. How do I know that guy's kid isn't an absolute moron, yet I have to pay him a minimum wage? Are you out of your mind? Listen to what's going on. And you are somehow wrapping patriotism around American communism called unions. See, that's the micro picture that they want you to focus on. It's the scams of this fat bastard that won't move out of his father's house. The macro picture is when government protects unions like Trump is doing with the tariffs. If you took away the municipal purchases of Ford, they would go out of business. They're bankrupt. Unions destroy quality. Always have, always will.
Are those are those waves crashing behind you, Sean?
Those are waves, and you're determined.
What
to
a life!
My thing, first of all, but it comes from massive hard work, 7 days a week, traveling constantly, and I'm very proud of it. And you know what? Sometimes I crap out. Sometimes I do all this, and it goes sideways. And I never complain. I never cry, and I never demand a minimum of anything, because when you demand a minimum, that's all you're going to be. Minimum.
Thanks, Sean.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
All right, listen up, Michael Rotundo and all you other stay-at-home sons. You professional gamers who are not being compensated for your professional gaming, we may have an outlet for you here if you want to get back in or enter I mean, in some cases, we're not talking about get back to the workforce, talking about entering the workforce. This dovetails nicely on the discussion we were having about the war on work as dirty jobs, as Mike Rowe was describing it. Our next guest is Montez King. He's the executive director of the National Institute for Metalworking Skills, and he's also a member of President Trump's Task Force on Apprenticeship Expansion. Montez King, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hi, thank you for having me. I'm very excited to be on your show today.
Well, we're happy to have you. And so, you know, one of the things we were just talking about is it's sort of a seemingly contradictory thing to say when you've got historically low unemployment and we're talking about all of these unfilled positions in manufacturing, in the trades, and yet we have 62% labor participation rate. So there is, you know, a delta there somewhere among some demographics. And I wonder what you would say in terms of the opportunities and metalworking generally, or metalworking specifically, and just apprenticeship programs in the trades generally.
Well, I'd like to say that when it comes to the work and learn model of apprenticeships, it is, you know, it's been, it's made me impervious to the marketplace. You know, there's economic downturns that happen every so often, maybe every 7 years or so. And I'm 45 years old now. I've seen, you know, the market go up and down, and with my skills in the machining trades, you know, I'm impervious to it. I'm always working, and you know, I grew up in a poverty-stricken neighborhood. You know, it's underserved. It's easy to fall into the wrong track, and you know, working in this, being introduced to the trade has just changed my life forever. So, all of those kids that are, I call them falling under the walking dead syndrome. You know, they're either they're looking at going to the traditional college track or they're doing nothing at all. Just in 6 months, gaining a few skills, you can actually enter into a gateway position that can change your life forever.
Well, how did sorry for interrupting you. How did you get into the trades?
Well, you know, I was actually running the streets as a young kid in Baltimore City. And there were a few kids in the neighborhood that they seemed like the good kids. They said they wanted to go to a trade school that was all the way across town. It's about 30 miles. About 30 miles on the other side of town. And I just jumped on a bandwagon and said, you know what, let me give this a shot. Let me try it and see if I can apply for this trade school. But they were only accepting 90 people in business administration. That's where my mind was thinking. And this at the open house, there was this guy that was standing in a dark hallway. It was all the parents were at the business administration and the cosmetology, all those areas. And I just went down this dark hallway because I thought I saw something. And to be honest with you, this white guy just jumped out of the room and grabbed me by my shoulders and started shaking me and said, "Hey, I'm looking for a few good black guys for this trade." I'm like, "What the heck is going on?" Right?
Oh, that's a great story.
Yeah, he scared me more than anything. He introduced me to the trade, and he's been my mentor ever since. And I've never worked in a McDonald's or Burger King. It's always been in the trade.
Well, I just wanted to underscore something you said, and maybe have you provide some more specifics to it, because I hear this from owner operators of manufacturing businesses in the Chicago metropolitan area too. It's like, look, man, we'll train somebody who comes to the table and says, "I'll be here at the required time and I'll work my butt off to the required end of the day, and all I need is to be trained and to learn." And these guys are willing to take that raw material, that person that doesn't come to the table with skills in a particular trade, and train them because they're so desperate for reliable talent in this space.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And that was my other point, is that if you can walk in with zero skills, because there's such a need, there's such a skills gap, and we're looking for bodies. I mean, basically, you know, the way you look for employment and these trade skills, which are very technical, is you put a mirror under their nose and make sure they're breathing. You're trying to find that right person. But, you know, you can change your life significantly in a small period of time, and then you can do it in chunks. You know, you can stack onto your career and just keep learning additional skills. And, These employers, they're out here. They're ready to go. And one of my big customers, we were just going over the statistical numbers for salaries, and their average pay for their technical skills jobs is $107,000.
Yeah, I know.
Wait, how much?
$107,000. Amy wants to go into one of these apprentice programs.
Yeah.
That's the thing. And also, too, I mean, the apprentice program, you know, is basically like a probationary period in any other job, in a white-collar job or something like that. But, I mean, an internship, right? 6 months, and oftentimes you're getting help in terms of getting some pay to get through the apprenticeship program until you can get a full-time 40-hour work week.
Absolutely. And then, of course, I'm a part of the Presidential Task Force for Apprenticeship Expansion. And right now, apprenticeships only represent, as good as apprenticeships are, apprenticeships only represent 3/10 of our entire workforce. But if you go across the pond, it represents about 30%. It's 3/10 of 1% here in the U.S., and across the pond is about 30% of their entire workforce. And apprenticeships are such a great solution for that work and learn model, because you're not building up debt in college. You're actually learning skills that you can actually employ on the job right now. And now with this new industry recognized apprenticeship program model that we're working on at the presidential level, there's more flexibility where we're even adding in pieces to recognize what companies are currently doing, but not necessarily registered, as well as we're adding in pieces for articulation. So now you can get college credits for that work and learn apprenticeship model and still have that career pathway that parents want to see. I want my kids to earn a degree. Well, you can earn a degree. I mean, what's the average now for a bachelor's? Probably 6 years. If you're on a work and learn model, you can get practical experience and come out with a degree at the same time if you work hard.
So where do we sign up? I have two young boys, and, you know, I've noticed, you know, I've just recently taken tours of different high schools. Lane Tech used to be technical, and they did a huge auto shop component to their curriculum, and that's all gone. And tool and die making, that's all gone too. So how do we get involved in the trades?
Well, and that's where I think the parents need to understand the truth. Most of us, I do a reality check with the parents, and I do this quite often to get them to realize what's happening. And I say, who are advocates of the trade? And you get many people that will raise their hand and say, I'm an advocate of the trade. And I say, keep your hands up. If you have children that are at a decision-making stage, or know someone who has children at a decision-making stage for their careers, and most of them keep their hands up. Now, I say, only keep your hands up if those kids are moving in the direction of the skilled trades. And those hands start to come down because people are saying, well, I want my kid to go to college. Well, that doesn't mean we don't need kids going to the straight college track. But what it says is what 90% of our population, our young kids, are going towards the college track, yet less than 50% of the jobs require something more than a high school diploma, but less than a 4-year degree. So everyone's going for the same jobs, but then we have this large pot of jobs that can't be filled that actually pay in many cases more than those jobs with the 4-year degrees.
So
the parents need to see the truth.
Yeah, right. It's sort of the education bias to some extent. Task Force on Apprenticeship Expansion. So what's the kind of quickest way you see to expand apprenticeship programs and knowledge of apprenticeship programs, exposure to them? Is it by integrating them into the curriculum of more high schools, or what's the play?
Yeah, the play here is that, one, we want to recognize what companies are doing well now. And that's a huge issue where, you have the registered model. We have an apprenticeship model, the Apprenticeship Act of 1937. But it has a box around it. And so there are many companies out there may not necessarily want to be registered, but they do have on-the-job training. And so we want to recognize what the companies are currently doing and not just say, well, you're not registered, so you're not a part of the system. We want to put it back in industry's hands, where industry can recognize those programs that are truly recognized as apprenticeships. And then we want to bring the colleges together to start articulating into credits that work experience, rather than saying, Well, you know, it's a part of an apprenticeship, so we won't articulate that into college credits. No, we want to change that culture where it is recognized. So recognize the thousands of companies out there that has OJT or on-the-job training. That's one piece. Articulating that into college credits, that's another piece. And showing the parents that the career pathway towards these jobs, within these jobs, are just as valuable and pay just as much, if not more, than that college track, but without the debt.
Yeah, and
because most the companies are paying for that training.
Yeah, right. We got a tweet from Jerry Stoklosa. Local 73 sheet metal apprenticeship, which is here in Chicago area, starting pay is $18-$20 an hour. Not too shabby. Yeah, not too shabby when you otherwise have people protesting in the streets for, you know, $15 an hour working at McDonald's or whatever. You know, there are other pathways other than picking up a placard. Montez King, executive director of National Institute for Metalworking Skills. He's also a member of President Trump's Task Force for Apprenticeship Expansion. Montez, thanks so much for joining us and sharing your insights. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Dan and Amy, as Amy mentioned, breaking news, President Trump has called off the summit with Kim Jong-un, and he dispatched envoy Roman Maroney to read the letter to the North Koreans.
You lousy corksuckers, you have violated my Fargan rights. This Samanambaching country was founded so that the liberties of common patriotic citizens like me could not be taken away by a bunch of Fargan ice holes like yourselves. Thank you very much.
That was thoughtful.
No, the letter's a little bit different. It says, sadly, based on the tremendous anger and open hostility displayed in your most recent statement, I feel it is inappropriate at this time to have this long-planned summit meeting. He did thank him, though, for releasing the hostages, calling it a beautiful gesture. Basically, somebody in North Korea's on Kim Jong-un's team called Vice President Mike Pence a political dummy, and that was just too much, so the summit's been called off for now.
But he is keeping his mind open. If you change your mind having to do with this most important summit, please don't hesitate to call me or write. Let's grab a bite and talk about it.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.